22 through 56, and this morning I want to speak to you about traveling through life with Jesus. It would have been interesting to have traveled with Jesus. Those 3.5 years that he spent here as a minister and as a servant of God, teaching and preaching and doing all of the miracles that he did. And there's no doubt in my mind that those apostles whom he chose had a unique experience in all of those who have lived upon this earth, and that is they got to travel through life, or at least a part of their lives, with Jesus. And as I thought about that and was preparing the thoughts that I have before me this morning, I realized that really we're traveling through life with Jesus. That he has promised to be with us, that he has promised to be conscious of who we are and what we do and where we go, of our joys and our griefs. But he is an unseen traveling companion. I do not see him in the morning when I arise, and I do not bid him good night personally or visibly in the evening. But I know that he is alive, that he is a resurrected Lord, that in spirit, that he is present with me as I live my life on earth. So in a very real sense, I think we can say that we are traveling through life with Jesus. And I confess at the very beginning that this message is hermeneutically incorrect, probably homiletically incorrect, but I think we'll learn some truths that will help us as we travel through life with Jesus. There are some 4 stories here that have to do with the experiences of Jesus and those who were traveling with him. We may think these incidents and circumstances, we may think of them as representing possible experiences that may be in our future. That is, we see a circumstance where faith is mentioned by the Lord in what started out as a day-to-day living experience, and then it turned to fear and it turned to desperation. We also look at something extremely unique that happened in the life of Jesus and in the lives of the apostles and others who were with him. That is, they met a person who was extraordinary in his behavior. He was a man possessed of devils. He lived in a cemetery. He raged at people as they came close, and he was without clothing. No doubt a fearful, fearful sight to see. And Jesus took this unique circumstance and turned it into something very ordinary. I don't know that that happens to us very much, to take the extraordinarily unique and then by the power of God, see, it turned into something quite ordinary. Then, of course, as we think about the woman who had an issue of blood, who while Jesus was on his way to attend to a sick person, that she touched the Lord. It was a crisis in her life because she was ill. She'd spent all of her money on physicians and evidently was in a rather desperate circumstance. And then we see the final experience of walking through life with Jesus, and that is death. That which had originally been my child lieth sick, to thy child is dead. So there are many things in these scriptures this morning that help us to think about the power of God and the necessity of walking with the Lord as we live this life. So let's think first of all of Jesus and the day-to-day. You know, that's a rather trite expression, but that's how we live life, and oftentimes we get bored with it, just being a day-to-day experience. Same old is how we oftentimes describe our existence on earth. But the scriptures tell us that it came to pass on a certain day that he went into a ship with his disciples. And the objective of the day was to cross over unto the other side of the lake. Now that wasn't unusual for them. They did this consistently. It wasn't an outing. It wasn't a picnic. It was just another day, a day-to-day thing. And the scriptures call it just a certain day. Let's go to the other side of the lake. But like so many days, this day turned sour. Because in verse 23, the Bible tells us that a storm of wind fell on the lake. That's descriptive of the suddenness by which this storm came upon them. It fell upon them. They had little warning, and it was a violent windstorm, and the Bible tells us that the ship was filled with water. And they were, in their thinking at least, in grave danger. For the Bible tells us that they use the expression, "We perish. We perish." So in their mind, they thought that everyone on board that ship was going to die. Now that's quite a change from your day-to-day experience. Friday, I was around the church here, and I heard a rather large sound. I thought something had fallen or I really didn't know, and so I looked around, and there were two automobiles at the corner of Prickett Road and Highway 5, and my people, be careful. That is a dangerous intersection. And I saw these two cars just sitting there, both of the front ends just destroyed. And I started to use my cell phone and call 911. And about that time, a fire truck came in behind them, and I knew they'd take care of it. Later on, talking to some of the people who knew the emergency crew, said that an elderly man had been driving. He'd been sideswept by another car and had hit another car head on. And they said he died on the way to the highway. You know, I imagine what a tragedy that became, because it was probably just a day-to-day thing. Going to the doctor, go get some groceries, and then it ends in death. These people thought that this ship was going to sink and they were going to drown, and they awoke Jesus and they complained that we're going to die, we're going to perish. And you know what? Jesus had been sleeping through this whole matter. And he asked the question, "Where is your faith?" And that question had the implication in it, "Where's your trust?" And it more or less was a question about, "Don't you trust me? You've seen me do some wondrous things. Now, don't you trust me?" And sometimes in our day-to-day living and working, things go sour. Maybe they don't end in such a tragedy as I've described, and maybe you're not as frightened as these people were who said we perish. There are a lot of scary things that happen to us. And when these scary things happen to you in your day-to-day life, I can assure you that you're traveling through life with Jesus, and that he is there, and that you can turn to him and you can trust him, because he is a trustworthy worthy being. Jesus has never not done what he said he would do. So in your day-to-day existence, and even in the common and ordinary, always remember that the Lord is there. And he can calm us as he rebukes the storms that afflict us in this life. And then there's Jesus and the unique. A few times in our lives we encounter the unique. For Jesus and the disciples, it was the maniac of Gadara. What a frightening phrase, the maniac of Gadara. The Bible tells us that he had devils a long time, that he wore no clothes, and he lived as an animal in and around a graveyard. Some have speculated that his food came from eating the corpses that were laid there in the tombs. Jesus, or the Bible, Luke refers to this as a certain man, just like he referred to the day as a certain day. So there's certain days and certain men, unidentified, unnamed, by month and date or initial or last name or nickname, just the man of Gadara, a maniac. And he said to Jesus, and it's strange that this man recognized Jesus, and he asked a rather unique question after addressing Jesus as the Son of God Most High. Thou Son of God Most High, torment me not. I never thought about Jesus in the sense of his tormenting people. But you know, I think the world looks at Jesus that way from time to time. Jesus Christ, a tormentor. That is, one who brings grief and sorrow into the life of others. I can't conceive of him as a tormentor. Perhaps some do look upon him that way, and this is the request or statement that this man made, and evidently he is saying to Jesus, don't make me worse. Don't worsen my condition. Don't make me worse than I am. I know you're the Son of God, and I know you have power over devils, and whatever you do, don't make it worse. But Jesus cast the devils out into the swine. And this man then was found sitting at the feet of Jesus and in his right mind. Talk about extraordinary miracles. Here's a man who was violent in his behavior. Had frightened people, no doubt, many times as they passed by on the road near this cemetery. But now Jesus has cast out the devils. He's no longer tormented. And he's sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. And from the unique and extraordinary, Jesus has now brought about the ordinary. And this man in verse 38, the Bible tells us that he wanted to go with Jesus. That's not difficult to understand. Now the man out of whom the devils were departed besought him that he might be with him. And this was an honest request, worded from a heart filled with gratitude and a physical well-being that this man had not known, no doubt, in years. And what a witness this man would make. What a crowd gatherer this man would make. I would have, in my mind, believed that any evangelist would have been an immediate success by taking this man with him, showing him, letting him give his testimony. And maybe many people would have known him personally, and perhaps his plight, at least, had been gossiped all over Judea. the wild man, the tormented man, the crazy naked man that runs among the tombs in the cemetery, violent, vicious. Jesus could have touted him, used him, held him up as to what he could do. But Jesus took the unique and turned it to the ordinary. He said in verse 39, "Return to thine own house and show how great things God hath done unto thee." And he went his way and published throughout the whole city how great things Jesus had done unto him. Sometimes when we find the unique, we want to take it, take advantage of it, and use it. What a great fundraiser it would have been. As I've said, what a great testimony it would have been. But Jesus knew what the right thing was to do. Instead of making a carnival freak out of this man, he made an ordinary home man out of this person who witnessed to his city and made a tremendous impact on those people among whom he lived. If you ever have something terribly unique happen to you, or you're involved in it, make sure you don't use it for your benefit. Make sure that God uses it for his benefit. There are a lot of two-headed calves and crippled and pitiful people in this world. But I don't think God wants us to use people like that in a bad sense. That if we can, let us make their lives ordinary. Because people who are unique, more than anything else, want their lives to be ordinary. And then there's Jesus and the critical circumstances. The crises that we find ourselves in from time to time. In verse 41, there's a ruler of the synagogue, a rather important person, the first one. And his crisis was both physical and emotional. In verse 42, it expressed this way: "One only daughter, about 12 years old, and she lay a dying." This man, Jairus, verse 41, he came and fell down at Jesus' feet and besought him that he would come into his house, for he had one only daughter, about 12 years of age, and she lay a dying. But as he went, the people thronged him. That's a crisis. Your only daughter, 12 years old, she's deathly sick. She's dying. That is a crisis. Things are critical. But you have to set this aside for a minute. Because we have this crisis interrupted by another crisis. So just kind of push from your mind Jairus and his daughter sick unto death at his home, and think with us now about this crisis being interrupted by another crisis. Verse 43 tells us a woman had an issue of blood for 12 years. She had an abnormal bleeding that made her unclean according to the law of Moses, Leviticus 15:25. She had exhausted her resources on medical care, and no physician was able to help her. And this is no indictment of the medical profession. It's only a comment on their limitations. But she had spent all, the Bible tells us, and could not be healed of any. So she came behind. She was literally hiding. And that word is used in verse 47 when it states that when the woman saw that she was not hid, and she touched the hem of the garment of Jesus. And Jesus said, "Somebody hath touched me, for I perceive that virtue has gone out of me." The word virtue here is a word that's translated power. Jesus realized that spiritual and literal power had left his body. And you'll see something in this woman of her character and her faith in what she did. Because she would not touch his body, because this would have made Jesus unclean, and he would have to have gone through a process with a priest and perhaps even the temple in order to be cleansed so he could continue his ministry. She knew this. She would not touch him. So she touched the hem of his garment. She had modesty. She had faith. She had character. And Jesus said so. The Bible tells us that he expressed himself in this fashion: "Daughter, be of good comfort. Thy faith hath made thee whole. Go in peace." Do you notice so far Jesus said, "Where is your faith?" to those who thought they would perish in the storm, indicating that they had not trusted him as they should. To this madman who said, "Don't torment me, don't make this worse," Jesus cast out the devils and gave him an ordinary life, a life he could live like everyone else, not a freak at a sideshow. And now to this woman who has had 12 years of misery and suffering and something of a social outcast, who spent every penny on doctors just like we would. We have serious health problems. We'll go to Mayo's Clinic. We'll go wherever we need to go to get the kind of help we need. And how badly we feel if a loved one needs such medical attention and we don't have the money. I can remember that time when hospitals didn't have free care. I know people who died at home because there was just no money. No money. To be sick and have no money, that's crisis. That's critical. There's not anything can make you feel any worse than to be sick and have no money, to have a loved one who is sick and to have no money, and you've gone the very last mile you can go, and now you've got to do something. And this woman knew that Christ was coming, and her character was of such a nature she didn't want to touch him and cause him to be unclean, to unburden herself upon him so that he would be so dramatically affected. But she had some faith. And it was enough to touch the hem of his garment. Jesus felt that surge of power leave him. And he turned to her and said, "Daughter, be of good comfort." Have you noticed how Jesus is always expressing himself to us? Be of good comfort. Be of good cheer. Fear not. And that is a difficult lesson to learn. It's a difficult lesson to learn. I'd rather suspect that memorizing Webster's dictionary would be easier than learning to be of good cheer in a circumstance such as this woman found herself. But faith can do that for us. Trust can do that for us if in our lives we find ourselves in that crisis. And Jesus brought this to a happy ending. But now let's go back to crisis number one. And that is, my only daughter, about 12 years of age, she lay a-dying. But this crisis, this original crisis, it has escalated in its severity. It has gone from lay dying to thy daughter is dead. Dying, lay dying is serious. It's heart-wrenching. It's dynamic in its effect upon us, but thy daughter's dead. No sadder sentence ever fell from the lips of mankind. And as we think about this, probably the whole crowd goes silent. And Jairus could have blamed Jesus for his delay to heal the woman. He could have blamed this woman who stopped Jesus for those few minutes that Jesus could have gotten to his home and healed his daughter before she died, and now he's been delayed. And oftentimes we look at what happens in our crisis, and it's easy to blame someone who delayed us or interfered in it and caused us to be where we are. And we can feed on that and become bitter and angry, and perhaps this Jairus could have just stormed off somewhere in his bitter anger toward Jesus because he just didn't get there in time. But let me tell you something. When something happens to you because you think God just didn't get there in time, God didn't learn about it quick enough, I can tell you, and I can ask you, and I can inform you, where is your faith? God's never late, but then he's never early either. And what did Jesus tell this man? Same thing, fear not. Believe only, and she shall be made whole. Don't be afraid. Don't be filled with fear. And I can tell you, I know from my own experiences, I'd be filled with fear. And I may have described myself when I talked about Jairus as possibly being angry at Jesus. I can tell you, I know from my own personal experiences. But in verse 52, the Bible tells us that when they arrived at the home, and listen carefully, when they arrived at the home, things were normal. And you say, things were normal? Yes, notice, all wept and bewailed her. That's normal when someone dies in her home, is it not? To weep and to mourn and to give loud vent to our feelings about what has happened. And it's a tragedy because it's a 12-year-old only daughter, and it's a time for weeping, it's a time for mourning, no doubt about that. And there were those with Jesus, no doubt many people, but he chose Peter, James, and John. Peter, James, and John, three people. Father, the mother. That's what the Bible tells us. And he came into the house. He suffered no man to go in save Peter and James and John and the father and the mother of the maiden. So we have Peter, James, and John, the father, the mother, a dead body. That's all that's in the room. Jesus, the dead body, father, mother, Peter, James, and John. Now, Jesus said in verse 52, when they had come into this circumstance, into the room where she was lying, just this small group of people, and the Bible tells us that Jesus said, weep not. Fear not, weep not, be comforted, be of good cheer. These are all at the front end of this stuff. I can see pronouncing, now be happy, be of good comfort, don't be afraid, after the fact. I can see that, can't you? Now your daughter's raised from the dead. Be of good cheer. Oh, surely I can be of good cheer. Surely I can. Fear not. The winds have stopped and the boat's not filled with water. It's a wonderful circumstance. Oh, thank you. Yes, Jesus, I will trust you. But he says these things before the fact. What are they doing? Weeping and bewailing. And Jesus says, weep not. She's not dead, but sleepeth. Now, what he's saying is, I can awaken her. He's not saying that there is no state of deadness, that people don't die, things of that nature. What he's saying is, to me, she is sleeping. No more than when she was sleeping 2 days ago and you went into her room and awoke her. That's the same circumstance in which I find myself with her. My power as the creator of all the universe, I can raise this girl from the dead and she'll be as though she was raised from a sleep. The Bible said he called to her. And that is, he simply spoke clearly. Made arise. And her resurrection was a total restoration of her health and well-being because Jesus said to them, give her solid food. He didn't start her out on soup. He didn't start her out with an IV. He said, give her solid food. And then he turned to the parents. And the Bible says they were astonished. That is, they were standing aside. They had moved back. They had gotten away from the circumstance. No doubt they'd crowded the wall of this little bedchamber. It also means to be out of your mind in the sense of losing mental contact with what's going on. And Jesus charged. And that means it was the same as a military command. And what he charged them was that they should tell no man what was done. Of course, that was necessary because Jesus knew that he had other things to do and that his crucifixion was ahead, that he would have to go to Jerusalem to be betrayed, to suffer and die. It wasn't time for him to be stoned to death as a blasphemer in this backwater village after having done such a tremendous thing. And so he said, don't get out and tell everybody what happened in here. Again, you can see how oftentimes what we would have taken the most advantage of, that would have been, we couldn't have just, it was just so fantastic. We're just going to have to say what happened. And yet God doesn't intend for us to always broadcast everything that happens to us. Be careful with it. And the reason you need to be careful with it, if you're not careful, you'll make you're the person who achieved it rather than God who gave it. You know, you let this thing be told for a while. Peter, James, and John, and maybe mother and father are soon saying, you know, I really felt like that when Jesus got there, he'd raise her from the dead. You know, we sort of begin to put ourselves into the miracles of God sometimes. And I mean miracles in a sense of how things turn out, not miracles such as raising the dead, but you know, that which is so difficult for us not to sort of put ourselves into it some way, somehow, and in the telling of it, take a little credit for knowing a few things, of having done a few things, sort of on the sly. Well, I saw these other guys cowering in the boat, shaking with fear, and I sort of went along because I didn't want them to feel badly. But, you know, I really wasn't afraid. Liar. Liar. Oh, I knew Jesus would come and he would still the wind and he would still the waters. I knew all along that was happening. And I've just sort of, you know, a lot of things we like to work our way into it. Enough said. But let us consider. How is your day-to-day life? When the wind falls on you, are you filled with fear? Or does something tell you from your heart and from your mind, from your knowledge of God, from your experiences, from what you've learned, fear not. I can have a greater power here with me in this circumstance. I didn't start out to be challenged. And I didn't start out to have an encounter with a unique, but here I am. Are you overawed and do you move away or solve the problems and seek to take advantage of it then? Can you return it to the ordinary? Can you put it in a context that whatever's happened now, we can go on with life even though something very unique and unusual has happened to us? How do you react to a crisis? I'm a perfect example. I go absolutely crazy. I become a part of it. First thing they want to do when I'm in a crisis is get rid of the preacher. Do you have faith like the woman who had the issue of blood? How do you react to death? Paul even warned us not to do what this mother and father did and friends and neighbors did, and that is to weep and bewail to a high level. Sorrow not as others who have no hope, because the hope we have is the resurrection. Do you believe in the resurrection of the dead? Do you believe that? That God, through His mighty power, can raise up people who, if they wanted to, could take solid food. I believe in the resurrection, don't you? I'm moved by death. I'm frightened by death. I have a great fear of death. Not the end result, but the process. I don't fear death. I fear dying, because I've never done that before. I fear whatever there is to go through. I don't know how I'll die. And you don't know how you will die. There may be a long process. It may be sudden. I don't know, but there is a fear of the unknown in this process. And some of you lived through that and you got it out of your system because you were in World War II or you were in Korea somewhere or some other circumstance and the fear was there. And then you realized, I'm hopeless, I'm helpless, and you got rid of a lot of that. Do you believe in the resurrection? I hope you do. I hope you trust the Lord.